Hello and happy Monday. Everyone seems to be enjoying their lunch. I'm Tara Joseph with Thomson Reuters. It's a pleasure to have a real full house today. Everyone seems so relaxed. August is usually the month where we switch off our mobile phones, take a holiday, etc. But this has been a brutal August for anyone watching the financial markets. And I was interested to see our guest today, Mark Mobius, seeming very relaxed after what's happened to the markets. I think we've had emerging market equities down 15% year to date. And in August alone, I think funds in Asia lost about $77 billion worth of money. So where do we go from here? Well, Mark Mobius manages $50 billion in emerging market assets. So I hope he can give us some ideas as to what to do in these times. Mark?
Isn't it wonderful? The markets are down. That's the time I'm very, very happy. Unfortunately, a lot of our clients are not too happy. And I remember during the last downturn, during the Asian crisis, I was in Edinburgh, Scotland. And you know, the Scottish don't like to lose money. And this gentleman called in. By the way, my name is pronounced Mobius. And this gentleman called in. Apparently, he was a holder of our emerging markets fund. He said, now, about this emerging markets fund, I'd like to talk to Dr. Dubious. So we have to be very humble. What I'd like to do today in 20 minutes, because we'll leave enough time for questions, which is the most interesting part of these events, I want to give you a quick outlook on where we are with emerging markets. And of course, the first thing is performance. How is the emerging markets performance? And if we look at the 10-year performance, you'll see that emerging markets have outperformed the world and the US market by a very, very wide margin. If you look at the 5-year performance, again, emerging markets have outperformed by a very wide margin. If we look at the 2010 performance, again, emerging markets outperformed by a wide margin. But if you look at the recent, since January, actually emerging markets have underperformed. And I know a lot of people throw up their hands and say, oh God, you know, it's finished for emerging markets. No, it's not over. Why? If you look at history, the last 10 years, emerging markets outperformed, for full years at least, 9 out of 10. This year, I don't know what's going to happen by the end of the year, but it's not surprising that it might be underperforming, but I think it'll probably surge up again and outperform. So what I'd like to do is give you the reasons why we feel that the markets are behaving in the way they are. In order to understand the markets, you've got to understand supply and demand. It's a marketplace. If there's too much supply, the market is not going to do very well. If there's too much demand, the market is going to be doing very well because the prices will move up. But what happens is when the markets go up, you see a lot of new supply coming in. And if you look at the supply numbers for emerging markets since 2000, you'll see that back then, emerging market IPOs and follow-on issues represented about 10% of the global IPO and follow-on issues area. Now, in 2010, it went up to 50% of the total. So we've seen a lot of new issues coming in. These gives you the numbers. Of course, that blue line is the index. And of course, when the index goes up in 07, we had a very bullish market. The number of IPOs went up to roughly $370-80 billion. And last year, we saw over $460 billion in IPOs. So obviously, lots of supply, and that tends to have a depressing effect on the market, which, by the way, I think is great, because otherwise we would have had a bubble. If we look at where the IPOs are coming from, you'll see that China has grown dramatically compared to the U.S. Back in 2008, China represented maybe about 1/5 of the U.S. IPO market. Now, in 2010, they surpassed the U.S. If we look at emerging markets, after years of being under the U.S., now is far, far greater than the U.S. And of course, the U.S. is the largest market in the world. So we're seeing a lot of supply coming into emerging markets. Okay, how about demand? Where is demand coming from? If we look at the total market capitalization of emerging markets, and by the way, market capitalization is calculated by multiplying the number of shares outstanding in all these markets by the price. Of course, when prices go up, the market capitalization goes up, and if the number of shares go up, market capitalization goes up as well. If both go up, then we really have a big increase. But you can see that since 1998, when the percent of emerging markets was about 8, anywhere between 3 to 8%, we're now up to 34%. So when people ask me, what percent should I have in my portfolio in emerging markets, I tell them, you should have at least 34%, because that's the market, that's the percent that it is of the global market. But most people have between 3 to 8% in emerging markets, that yellow bar. Unfortunately, they don't listen at the bottom. They don't buy at the bottom. My sister-in-law, when there was a big boom before the Asian crisis in emerging markets, went into our emerging markets fund. The next year, when the market tanked, I had to visit my brother in Buffalo, New York. And I remember knocking on the door. I heard her voice behind the door, "Who's there?" I said, "It's Mark. I'm not opening the door, and give me my money back." I said, "If you open the door, I'll tell you how to get your money back." She opened it, but left the chain on the door. She said, "How?" I said, "Buy more." She slammed the door in my face. This is the situation we have in these markets. And very, very few people have 34% of their portfolio in emerging market stocks. And I'll tell you, there are a lot of reasons why it should be more. And it's happening, because you can see the net inward flows into emerging market funds like our own are growing very rapidly, as you can see from this chart. What are the fundamentals? Why do we think that people should be in these markets? Well, first of all, it's all about growth. Emerging markets this year will be growing 3 times faster than the developed countries, US, Japan, Western Europe. 3 times faster. Even the most pessimistic forecast. By the way, I decided to downgrade our China forecast, and then I looked at the consensus. The recent consensus is up, it's not down. If you look at China and India this year, the consensus is that China will grow by 9%, India will grow by almost 8%, compared to 1.7 for the US and a minus number for Japan. So the growth is there, there's no question about it. The next is, by the way, another thing I think we have to get straightened out. There's some people who have been saying, for some reason I cannot fathom, there's no relationship between the stock market and economic growth. I don't know where they get this, but I think I figured it out. Because they've done correlation analysis. You know, they say, okay, let me take January to December and correlate the stock market with the economic growth. And it's a negative number. They don't correlate. Why? Because the stock market is a leading indicator. It moves up before the economy moves up. So of course there's no correlation. Doesn't mean there's no causation. The causation is definitely there. There's a strong relationship between economic growth and the health of the stock market, because companies depend on economic growth. The other factor is foreign reserves. Since 2005, foreign reserves in emerging markets have been growing faster and are greater than those in the developed countries. And if we look at China, you all know, we're almost at we're probably past 3 trillion now. Japan used to be the biggest, it's 1 trillion. Saudi Arabia, Russia, over 400 billion. Taiwan, over 300 billion. Korea, Brazil, India, Hong Kong, over 200 billion and growing. Incredible foreign reserves in these countries. Let's look at the debt. You've been hearing about the debt problems in Europe and the US. How about emerging markets? If you look at the debt to GDP ratio for emerging markets, you'll see it's going down, while the debt to GDP ratio for the developed countries is going up. So there's a big divergence here in these two areas. And if you look at individual, if you look at individual debt, excuse me. If you look at individual debt to GDP ratios for both personal and private debt, you'll see that the developed countries are at the top, those blue and gold bars, and the emerging countries are the red and purple. Big, big difference. And of course, if countries have high foreign reserves and low debt to GDP levels, the bond investors and other investors start to pay attention because they figure they're going to probably get their money back for those countries that have high foreign reserves and low debt to GDP levels. Let's look at valuations. A lot of people have witnessed the increase in emerging market stock prices. But if you look at the valuations, we of course are not as cheap as we were at the beginning of 2009. But we're not as high as we were at the high points in the history since 1988. And you can see here the price earnings ratios average for emerging markets now are about 10 times, which is very, very much lower than it was back in 1988 when it was 28 times, and a little higher than it was at the low point in 2008. Similar story for price to book value. We're more or less in the middle of the range. Similar story for yield as well. So generally speaking, we are not as easy as it was when we were at the beginning of 2009, but we are still finding lots of opportunities out there, particularly with the continuing IPO activity, which is increasing supply. Now, many people ask, how about investment themes? Where are you investing? And we don't invest in themes, we invest in companies. However, if you look at the companies in which we are invested, you'll see that two themes seem to predominate. First is consumers. We believe in consumers in emerging markets. Why? Because there are more of them. You can see the population growth in emerging markets compared to the developed countries going up at a fast pace. And right now we're looking at 5.6 billion consumers in emerging markets versus 1.2 billion in developed countries. If we look at China and India alone, it's over a billion each, compared to the US and EU, below 400 million each. However, of course, per capita income is lower. US, UK, France, Germany, all over $30,000 a year. Russia and countries like that, below $11,000 a year in per capita income. However, that situation is changing very, very rapidly. Per capita income is growing at a rapid pace. And it stands to reason, because population is growing, but at a very slow pace. Let's be very, very conservative and say population is growing at 1%. If your growth rate is 8% or 7% or even 5%, per capita income is moving. So between 2005 and 2010, per capita income in emerging markets went up by 87% compared to 13% in the developed markets. And if you look at imports by these countries, you'll see the picture. Back in 1991, China took less than 2% of the world's imports. Now they're taking over 9% of the world's imports. By the way, that's direct imports. That doesn't include all the Gucci bags and Louis Vuitton bags being bought in Paris by Chinese and all the shopping that they're doing in Hong Kong. Lots of consumer goods as well as commodities. And the same thing is true of India. You've seen India taking a bigger and bigger share of the world imports. And the reason why we see potential is we just look at rural China. And by the way, the same story could be said of rural India, rural Cambodia, rural South Africa, wherever you want to go in the world. The goods and services in these rural areas is very, very low. Back in 1990, there was one refrigerator for every 100 households in China, rural China. Now there's over 30. Washing machines went from 9 to 49. Now it's probably 50 or 55. Computers, they hardly scratch the surface. They've got a long, long way to go. Bicycles are down. Back in 1990, there was over one per 100 households, over one per 100 per 100 households, over 100, 118 to be exact. Now it's 98. Why? Because they're buying motorcycles and automobiles. And you can see the sales of Chinese cars, of course, have far surpassed that of the US. And the same thing is true in India. Domestic automobile sales are going through the roof. And in Indonesia, motorcycle sales going through the roof. So it's a great, great market to be in when you see that kind of growth. And if you're in the beer business, beer consumption is going up in China and all these other countries. Spirits, you know, Mao Tai, whiskey, brandy, so forth. I was explaining to our European audiences when I was speaking the last month, I said, Mao Tai is the drink that they give to foreign diplomats before negotiations begin. Wine, you all know that the wine consumption is going up pretty fast. And of course, internet is growing at a very fast pace in these countries. The other theme is commodities. I know there's a lot of doubters who say, oh God, you know, oil prices coming down, so forth and so on. Sure, there's going to be a lot of fluctuation, but the trend is definitely up. If you look at the Commodity Research Bureau index, you can see, yeah, it overshoots that red trend line, but the trend is definitely up for all commodities. Copper, way up. By the way, you see, if you have to appreciate the difficulty of getting this stuff out of the ground. You heard, was last year they had these miners in Chile who were trapped in the mine deep underground. I remember early this year we went to Kazakhstan to a mine in the middle of the country. It took us 2 hours to fly to this place. I was with my two young analysts who had never been into a mine, and we were giving a briefing by the safety engineer because we had all the gear, you know, the oxygen and all the rest of it. And I asked the safety engineer, have you had any accidents this year? He said, yeah, only 11. And these two analysts looked at me. And I said, any deaths? Yeah, unfortunately, 3. This is mining. This is the difficulty of getting this stuff out of the ground. So the cost is not going to go down, believe me. Platinum. You need platinum and palladium for every automobile for the catalytic converters. Nickel, stainless steel, corn, now all these soft commodities are moving up. Sugar, soybeans. Soybeans were first cultivated in China, now they have to import. Gold. And recently, I'm sure you read about diamond prices now are moving up as a store of value. Interesting to note, of course, is the relationship between the dollar index going down and gold prices going up. And if you look at per capita income in China and the relationship between that and gold, it's very, very clear. And the same thing is true of India. Per capita income going up, gold prices going up. Crude oil, we use $80 a barrel as sort of our benchmark. I mean, in other words, if we are buying an oil company, we say if this company can make money at $80, it's a buy. If they can't, it's not. Because we believe, you know, oil prices will be around that level or higher going forward. And the reason, of course, is that emerging markets are taking a bigger share of oil imports. In 2005, emerging markets took 36%. Now it's over 47%, because this was 2009 figures. I think it's surpassed the 50% level. And of the five largest importers of oil in the world today, three are emerging markets. And of course, you can see China and India oil imports continuing to move upwards. Iron ore and other minerals in China, they continue to import more and more iron ore. So this is the picture in terms of where we are. The other opportunity we see are in the frontier markets. These are the little known markets that some people dare not to enter. You know, I remember someone said an emerging market is defined as a market from which you may not emerge in an emergency. And that's probably true of a lot of these frontier markets, but it's amazing to us that we now have over $1 billion in frontier markets funds, and we've had absolutely no trouble in getting invested and also meeting redemptions when they come. So you see in Eastern Europe, for example, Bulgaria, Croatia, Slovakia, Slovenia, Romania, we have a big office in Romania. By the way, we run a $3 billion fund for the Romanian government. And I remember when we first went into Romania, our analysts were a little concerned, because you know who comes from Romania, don't you? Dracula. Dracula actually is based on a real life hero in Romanian history, Vlad the Impaler. He was the leader against the Turks. And in order to scare the Turkish soldiers, he impaled all his prisoners and put them along the border. And of course, he got this bloodthirsty idea. And then Bram Stoker picked up on some German stories about this bloodthirsty ruler and made up. Actually, Bram Stoker never visited Romania. Do you know that? He wrote the Dracula story, but he never visited the country. Anyway, very nice country, beautiful country, nice people. Middle East, we have an office in the UAE and Dubai, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Lebanon. In the Latin American area, we're in Peru, in Ecuador, Jamaica, Panama, so forth. In Africa is big. Actually, right now, Nigeria is our biggest country weight in the frontier funds. But then you have a whole bunch of other countries. And of course, in Asia, you've got countries like Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. We're just going to be opening Laos. Laos has a small stock exchange that they're starting. So there's a lot happening in these markets. Just to give you an idea of the potential, this is the continent of Africa. And just as an exercise, someone tried to fit the land area of China, US, India, Mexico, Peru, France, Spain, Papua New Guinea, Sweden, Japan, Germany, Norway, Italy, New Zealand, United Kingdom, in the continent of Africa. And they succeeded. Africa is huge. There's an incredible resource base. And by the way, not only mineral resources and oil resources, but people resources, which I think a lot of people forget about. And if you look at the market capitalization of frontier markets, of course, it's tiny compared to emerging markets and developed markets. Average daily turnover also very, very small. But the number of listed companies is high. And what that tells you is that there are lots of cheap stocks, because market capitalization low, number of stocks high, that means the market capitalization of these companies is quite low, and chances are the prices are low. Daily turnover, however, is increasing. Back in 2003, it was about 0.8 billion. Now it's 2 billion a day and growing. They're at a very early stage of their development. If you look at population, they represent 17% of the world, 16% of land area, but only 6% of GDP. So they've got lots of growth potential going forward. If you look at the compounded annual GDP growth of frontier markets, it's actually faster, a little faster, not very much bigger, but a faster number than emerging markets generally. And if you look, this is really interesting. We took the 2001 to 2010 numbers for countries around the world to find the fastest growing countries. And it's amazing to me that it was Angola, China, of course China we knew about, Myanmar, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Kazakhstan, Chad, Mozambique, Cambodia, Rwanda. During that period, annual average growth was over 7% in these countries. The only country that's not a frontier market was China.
Mark, I don't want to interrupt your zeal on frontier markets, because I know it's one of your most interesting aspects of what you do. But we've got about 10 minutes left for Q&A, and I want to make sure we get that in.
Let me end with this chart. This is the Emerging Markets Index, and it shows the three major bear markets. By the way, we define a bear market as a 35% decline. 20% these days is nothing. The first big one was Asian financial crisis. Second was the dot-com boom and bust. And the last one, of course, was the subprime. If you notice, the distance between the high and the low of the bear market is very narrow, very low. The rest of the areas are bull markets. If you summarize it, you see that on the average, since 88, bull markets went up by 423% and lasted an average of 69 months, while bear markets went down an average of 57% and lasted an average of 14 months. So, what can we conclude? Bull markets last longer than bear markets. Bull markets go up in percentage terms more than bear markets go down. So many years ago, Sir John Templeton, our founder, was at a conference like this, and we took questions from the audience. And one young lady got up and said, "Sir John, I just inherited some money. I'd like to know, when should I invest?" Sir John said, "Young lady, the best time to invest is when you have money." And I couldn't quite figure out what he meant until I studied this. If you're doing systematic investment month after month, same amount, you're going to be in bear markets very, very few times. Most of the time, you'll be in bull markets. Thank you very much.
So we have microphones in the audience. Please raise your hand, tell us where you're from, and we'll get a microphone over to you. Over in the back of the room at table number 3 to begin.
Mr. Mobius, thank you very much for your excellent talk.
My
name is Andrew Haskins. I'm a financial analyst based here in Hong Kong. But I was in Hong Kong before, but I've actually just come back from nearly 2 years in the Middle East. And that was a very interesting experience because, of course, nobody predicted the Arab Spring revolutions, which, of course, are still continuing today. And that's fascinating because it raises the issue of political risk, which is something that maybe you did not touch on in your talk. And I wonder, is there any way for you to try to build political risk into the investment decisions that you make? Thank you.
Yes, we do keep tabs on political risk. And the way we do that is with the famous misery index. I don't know whether you're familiar with the misery index. Inflation plus unemployment. And of course, we are faced with the misery index going up in many countries in the world, including the US, which is why you're seeing a lot of unhappiness among various populations. And of course, we saw that in the Middle East. We didn't know how it would work itself out, but we also knew that the internet, cell phones, and this incredible ability to communicate is resulting in an acceleration of political upheaval. Now, our attitude is as follows. We don't mind political change and political upheaval as long as we're able to get the money in and money out. So, for example, when Mr. or Colonel or General Chavez came into Venezuela, we were out because we knew that he would nationalize, confiscate, et cetera, foreign exchange controls. So what we try to do is assess, you know, what will happen and then invest accordingly. So if we think there's not going to be imposition of these controls and confiscation of assets, then we will take the opportunity to buy, to go in when people are very afraid. And that's the case now in Egypt, in other parts of the world where we see this kind of political upheaval. So that's the general attitude we take. We're not afraid to go in as long as we can get money in and out. And by the way, that includes some bloodshed and shooting on the streets, et cetera, et cetera. Usually you can find some terrific opportunities in those cases. Now, of course, we're not putting all our eggs in one basket. We're diversified. So, you know, a downturn in one market is not going to kill the portfolio. But on the upside, it can be very, very good.
How high do you rate the political risk factor in China, for example?
Very, very low, because although there are the problems that China faces just like any other country with trying to, you know, fight inflation on one hand and employment on the other, the chances of them confiscating assets or nationalization are low. This is quite low.
We have a question from Keith, New York Times.
Keith Bradshaw, New York Times. Every single category you showed for commodities was way above your trend line, and yet you still a couple times sound a little bullish just because of the growth in numbers from emerging markets. Are you more bullish on commodities or more bullish on the consumers in terms of industrial goods and so forth in the emerging markets?
Well, we are more bullish on the consumer side, but the problem is getting exposure to that because we found that many of those consumer stocks are overvalued, are somewhat expensive. So we take a five-year view and we try to predict what the earnings are going to be in a five-year time frame. And many of these stocks have, you know, a little bit overvalued. Although we are still, you know, finding opportunities, but it's a little more difficult than in the commodity space.
Question in the front, table number five. You still want to ask your...
Thank you. Todd Martin, Societe Generale. You have probably the biggest disparity of valuations across Asia since probably just before Asia crisis. Would that mean that you find more value in China, say, than Indonesia? And secondly, in your presentation, I didn't see anything on profitability. I saw a lot of growth. Yeah. And there's a lot of criticism of, in particular, China, of a lack of focus on profitability. I think those two might be correlated, so maybe if you could answer that, thank you.
Yeah, very good point. We happen to be heavily overweight in Thailand and Indonesia. And the reason is that in taking a five-year view, we are finding the numbers we reach in 5 years are much better than a lot of the numbers we are getting in China. So we, of course, are big in China, but the opportunities we find in those other places at this stage of the game seem to be quite good. And of course, you know, these things will change. With the Chinese companies, you have two big problems. One, there's a new supply, big supply coming in. If you look at the IPO activity, the banks need recapitalization. So they're going to be coming to the market. That means that, you know, the market, there will be an opportunity, but not at this stage of the game. The other thing we're finding is that if we look at these Thailand and Indonesia, they're now at the cusp of a new growth phase, particularly on the consumer side. In Thailand, Shinawatra is going to have a very populist program to put more money in the hands of the population. That means consumer. In Indonesia, they are attacking corruption, which means more hands, more money in the hands of consumers. So this combination of events seems to be helping us in finding opportunities there. Mind you, we're very, very cautious in which companies we buy, particularly Indonesia, because, you know, there's lots of corporate governance problems in these countries.
More questions from the audience? Over here, right in the back, table number 7.
Thank you. Tony Edwards, a private investor. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on, given recent news, the change in pace of internationalization of the renminbi, whether there's going to be any ramp up in that liberalization?
I think it's going to be accelerated, and we've seen signs of that. You know, it's interesting to note, a lot of people don't realize that appreciation since 06 has been over 20% of the renminbi. So a lot of people, you know, haven't noticed this continuing appreciation. But we think that it'll probably accelerate, but at a, you know, a gradualist approach. And the signs of that are here in Hong Kong. The amount of deposits that are going into renminbi accounts and the liberalization of policies allowing companies to raise renminbi to invest in China. So these moves is a sign that the Chinese government is feeling its way into greater and greater liberalization as we go forward.
Any more questions from the audience? Right here, we'll make this the last one.
Jackie O. Young, private office. Do you prefer in the frontier markets to invest in the local companies with local management or international companies, resource companies, for example, you know, operating in frontier markets and therefore listed in the first world markets?
We would love to invest in the international companies, but they're too expensive. So if you go into Unilever in Nigeria, it's very expensive. So instead we go into Nigerian breweries, which is, you know, they have some foreign relationship, but it's a, so we, I'd say generally speaking, we would go into local managed, for example, the banks in Nigeria would be all local. At the end of the day, you have to go local, because that's where most of the companies are going to be.
We'll leave it on that note, but I would like a final note on the yuan. You mentioned liberalization in the works. Do you have an estimate for when you think the yuan will actually be an international currency? How many years are you betting on?
Five years. I mean, it already is an international currency in the sense that anybody of any nationality in Hong Kong can get an RMB account. But if we're talking about a major force in a reserve currency, then we may be talking 5 years.
Okay, we'll leave it on that note.
Thank
Mark,
you.
Thank you very much. Before we wind up today, I noticed you'd like to sample our Correspondent's Choice wine, so a small gift from the club, if I can find it.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, and thanks to everyone for joining us today.
Thank you.